Hi, and welcome to Parent Talk with Bev. I'm a black British mother of West Indian descent with two children, 19 and 16 they are, and we're based in London, UK. I'm not an expert of any kind, I'm just sharing my thoughts, opinions and experiences around parenting in the hope that it would help another parent or someone somewhere. So grab your beverage or potter around as you listen. Warning, this could get deep. I want to acknowledge David Jones' media production titled How Can We Win? Interview with Kimberly Jones and also Trevor Noah, The Daily Show, for their contributions to my thinking this week. I claim no ownership of their materials, and I'll put the links below for those who want to do their own research and questioning. Of course, today's episode was meant to be about side by side, building together side by side, but it's complicated. So listen and let's see where this goes. I'm sitting here looking out at other people's gardens, and right beside me is my cat Bella. Those of you who've been listening to my journey on this podcast will know that she is always around and she always says things at inconvenient times, but right now she's snuggled up and sleeping, or so I think, just like I think my kids are sleeping. But anyway, listen anyway, and let's see. So you must can hear from my tone that I'm not as bright and sprightly as I normally am when I come here. This week has still been raw for me, as I struggle to try to put into words and understand for myself the impact of George Floyd's murder and the repercussions I see around via the many groups or WhatsApp groups that are sharing information, in the conversations that are either taking place or not taking place, in the need to want to take some form of action and not take any action. From sifting through my social media to not clicking everything that's coming at me so that I can reflect and not react. From hearing and seeing demonstrations taking place in my local area and within the UK. Today there was meant to be a protest which had been called a march, but that's been called off because the far right have made it clear they want to come out and fight, and some of us don't want to play into that game. All the while, I think it's just distracting us from other issues that will attempt to have an impact on Black lives here in the UK. And I can only speak about the UK because that's where I live, but I do know that there are things happening around the world. One thing that I recall from this week was an article saying that COVID-19 vaccine should be given to Black people first. Well, let me tell you something. I am fed up of being the guinea pig for the world. Another article, I think it said something about NHS staff or key workers being the first to have vaccines. And since I know that there are more people of colour in that profession, that target has been aimed, I find it funny that the British media and that blasted Prime Minister parade white staff in the media when they want to thank them for the work that they're doing or have done, yet you want to list and show Black people and ethnic staff when they have died. And then it just seems to me that you just want to justify your end game. Yet I don't know if you have even got a reliable test that confirms COVID-19 is even present, since it apparently mutates quickly. Also, since most of the population have been exposed to coronavirus, that's on many household, you know, little tins that we've got, and you read them and it says, oh, it's got coronavirus. We've all been exposed to coronavirus. So we've all got a trace of coronavirus in our systems to a less or more degree. So how can I trust that your test and its results are actually COVID-19 related? Don't get me wrong. I am angry and I do have a lot of passion, but I also have experienced or lived through the anger of my youth, where I jumped up on every cause and where there was a march or a vigil marking a spot where either arson had taken place, killing 13 young black people in a house party in Deptford, to the murder or wrongful death of a black man in police custody or after he had encountered the police, to the run-in with national fronters, the direct and indirect or overt or implicit racism that I've encountered in the education institutes, my workplaces, churches, and playing on the street. From the relationship choices I've made and the oppression I have encountered from men and women who, for whatever reason, felt that I posed a threat to them in some shape or form. This murder of George Floyd was so public, believe me, it's not new. Our men and women have been killed in various situations throughout my life. So many stories with so much pain that has been locked away. Locked away not just by me, but by my community. What do I do with all this pain? This pain that I can't talk about, but I feel so deeply. The difference for me is that we are in lockdown. We are in a pandemic, and yet that is not enough. I remember early 90s with the AIDS pandemic. The media again speculated and correlated that it come out of Africa. So black people were seen to be carriers and objects of hate. When other voices rose up from the gay and heterosexual community, it then became a we issue. So we are all in this pandemic, this COVID-19, yet it seems black people are being singled out as the group who are dying more than anybody else. I just feel that we're being scapegoated yet again, when all we're doing is dying. We are all dying. How long does it take for those who are sacrificed to shout, no more? I'm trying to get rid of some of this pain, but I know it's going to take time. And one of the saddest parts is that I thought my silence or my little piece of demonstrations or being part of a system to help change it from within, or that my protesting from outside was going to make a better world for my children. Yet, here I am, 40 plus years on, feeling that all I've done has been in vain and my children will still have to deal with the same crap. When will it change? When I was at university studying anthropology and sociology, and for those of you who don't know what that anthropology is, it's a study of non-Western culture, and sociology is the study of Western culture, right? A couple of things were obvious to me. One, in my first big lecture, we were all told that our experiences were valid. And then they spent the next 3 years telling me that my specific experience, that of a black woman, was peripheral on the outside of main theory, and unless it supported the main or was used as a critique by them to question the main, it really wasn't valid. And two, that academia was implicitly racist and subjective, and unless I changed my thinking to their way of thinking, that the degree I would end up with wouldn't be worth the paper it was written on. So imagine how that made me feel. Imagine how being the first person in my family to go to university really felt, realizing those things. So in my first year, you know, the initial first year, I was doing well. I was achieving firsts in my assignments, essays, or they call them dissertations. and I'd learned how to formulate and structure arguments, and I was doing it well. That's why I was getting firsts. But my second year became a battle. Not with them, but with me, because you see, as the first black person in my family to go to university, I had to struggle with the expectations that were put on me. My mum used to boast about me being at university, but didn't understand the battle I was facing. It's not her fault. She ain't been to university. Sorry, she hasn't been to university. Oh, boy. But she didn't really understand the things I was facing. Some of my friends disappeared because I was taking a different road to them. And once I get my teeth into something, I usually focus on what I'm doing. I found out that I was pretty good at these dissertations, presenting arguments and supporting them with evidence. Not that I took those grades for granted, because behind each dissertation, there was hours of reading, taking notes. I felt like I was dating the library and taking books and journals home instead of dating geezers, right? Men, sorry. I had late nights. I was drafting and redrafting my words and work to meet the criteria within the word count that they give you. I was trying to assimilate new ideas, relating them to the world around me and the lens of the life that I could see. And this was mentally exhausting. Friends in other disciplines said the same thing that I was either experiencing. And some friends I knew couldn't take it. One friend, who was an art graduate, had a piece of his final exhibition that depicted a slave ship. And at the bottom of it, he had placed human hair to symbolize our humanity and dehumanization. Unfortunately for him, the mental struggle was far more real. And I learned that he took his own life while I was still at university. Rest in peace, Dee. But for me, the big bang came when I had written a piece on whether I thought that European philosophers were implicitly racist. I felt I had written a balanced piece, with evidence from established and new thinkers on the points that I had crouched my argument in. And I had crouched my argument in the context of the new AIDS epidemic that was happening at the time. So that was early 90s. And what I remember then was that the press consistently referred to AIDS and Africa. They never directly said it came out of Africa, but everything around AIDS was Africa. So I felt the example was implicit, but however clever I might have felt, soon changed when the mark received didn't reflect that and was far removed from the firsts that I had consistently received. Because of these marks and my newfound confidence, I decided that in my final year, now, remember, I'm in my second year at this point, but I'd already made up my mind that in my final year, I was only doing pure dissertations for my final year. You know, 10,000 words each, and I was doing something like 4 or 5 or 6 of them as part of my final year in my degree, and I'd made the choices. So as an assertive black woman, or a naive black woman, I went to my professor, Paul Gilroy, the first black professor in that sociology department at that time, to challenge the mark that I'd received. Let's just say I walked out of that room made very aware that my view, argument, evidence were not seen as valid. Not by him, apparently, but by those marking it who had deemed it so. End of. This was mentally challenging for me. The weight of expectation to walk out with a good degree or stay true to my own cultural lens and argue that my voice and my experience was part of the educational landscape was some things that I had to really think about And then I had to think, was I really there just to re-spin what they had already re-spun, or for them to take my arguments and use it for their own agenda? I mean, I was confused, I was disillusioned, and I was mentally drained. I was questioning my own intellectual abilities, so much so that I wanted to disconnect from the degree. And I was looking at suspicion at this university that prided itself on being edgy and forward-thinking, only to have its underbelly revealed. Was this really the truth, or was I crap? Or was something else going on here? So I took that same piece of work and I found another professional within the university who was on an external site. And I asked if he could read the work and give it a mark, just out of curiosity. That ping, ping, pinging you're hearing is messages coming through, and I'm recording this on my laptop. So basically, you're just going to get everything that comes. I apologize. But let's carry on. So I gave this piece of work to this professional, right? Just to see what possible mark he would give. I didn't tell him anything about the mark that I'd had before, or the conversation I'd had with Gilroy, or anything. I just took this piece of work and just was like, just out of curiosity, wanted to find out how he viewed my argument and what kind of mark he might have given me. Now, remember, I really didn't know this geezer, so he's not giving this to me because he knows me. I had to go to somebody that I didn't know and just, you know, negotiate for them to read it, which I thank him that he did. And when he did, he'd given me a mark which was higher than what I'd received. So when I confessed the mark that I'd actually been given, him being another minority black academic at the university, he explained to me how he could see why they might have given me that mark. Didn't make me feel any better. But just to hear somebody who's not involved in the situation give you a perspective on it helps you. Well, it helped me. He explained that I had the option to challenge. So I was like, yeah, that's what I'm going to do. Mama never raised no fool. I'm going to challenge this. But then he let me know what the possible outcome might be. He asked me what I wanted to do after the degree. And I said that I wanted to do academic research. And he quietly told me that if I challenged this mark, that I would be black marked, and anything else that I presented could be marked down. Do you understand what that really meant for me at that time? It meant the degree result that I could walk away with would not reflect my true ability. And that if I was going for other jobs in academia, I'm going to be up against other people who would have on paper higher marks, but whether or not they would argue in the same way that I would, it wouldn't match. But they would get the job because their degree would be marked at a higher level than mine. Now, where have I kind of heard that before? Oh yeah. All of my educational life. I've been striving to show my critical thinking and contributions only to be told that it isn't enough. I've had to learn to regurgitate what's required to pass exams, but not having my thoughts or insights validated. I thought going to university would finally mean I'd be able to shine and that my intellect would be celebrated. Yet here I am walking away from this meeting with a heavy heart. Degree or no degree? That was now the question. What are you going to do, Bev? What are you going to do? You know, things look different for me anyway. When I was at university, when I joined, what was it called, the African Caribbean Society, and the group of us that were there at that time, we promptly set about changing the name from African Caribbean Society, because we thought that was too, it wasn't inclusive enough. There were people from outside of Africa and Caribbean who needed their voices. And so we changed it to the Black Diaspora Society, which caused a huge problem for the establishment. But we were just saying we wanted to claim our own space. Now, I remember when white students want to claim their space and exercise their spirit of protesting, that's seen as democratic and the right way of doing things. When black students do it, it causes trouble, or it's seen as causing trouble, or it's seen as a riot. But what we were actually doing was using the same mechanisms as others. When the student society had organized a sit-in, they were democratically seeking change. When we, from this Black Diaspora Society, organized a celebration of black culture with talks and workshops and events that we organized to take place, we were seen as radical. I lost the interest or enthusiasm in my learning, and I just wasn't interested in educating others about my experience and struggles. I needed to find like-minded people who looked like me and for whom the struggle was also real. And this, you know, alienated me from some of my friends at university. So you know, I know that the world isn't just black and white. There's lots of grey, and we have to navigate our way in that grey. So, university, I still had friends who were black, white, indifferent, all different colours, different nationalities. But I decided, one of the key things I decided back then was, I'm not going to educate you about my oppression. You need to educate yourself, because then I'm just taking the role of educating you and I'm not taking care of me. You know, many mothers leave their own children to educate others, and we're left to struggle on our own. I mean, my mum left me to clean when she first came here. She used to clean, the trains and offices. And when she got home from work, there was little time to do anything with me. She just wanted to focus on education and, you know, that I went to church. That was later. But my love says, I will signpost you to something and you do the work. What happens from there is up to you and up to God. I need to sit still here right now where I am, unburdening myself. I want to be able to talk to my children about this, not from a place of hate, but from a place of love. But I understand that I'm actually going through public and private stages of grief. Some people, including me at times, are still in shock. We're still numb, and we still can't find the words to express how we really feel. I looked up something that was talking about the five stages of grief. Denial, number one. I suppose the denial that the man literally killed this man on camera. And it's not the only one that we're seeing. And the fact that we're in lockdown, I can't run away from it or really distract myself from it or say it doesn't affect me because it's in the USA. Because actually, it's here in Britain too. Now you don't need guns. You just need a knee and your body weight on men and women who have already surrendered. Stage two is anger. Yes, there's riots, there's marches, but there's also silence because some of us are scared to talk. Some of us are numb from the build-up and accumulating, accumulation of pain from all the incidents before those happening now. And I'm allowing myself to remember them. Then stage three is bargaining. Just feeling helpless and vulnerable. I'm already feeling that. I'm already feeling as a group of people in lockdown made to feel invisible when you hail white faces only representing NHS. When anyone who goes to the hospital here can see the sea of multicultural faces. Knowing inside information that the NHS staff are scared to really say what's going on in their units, where they are not given adequate protective clothing, where those NHS staff, who for them English is a second language, are being rotated to work in the coronavirus 19 units. And because they don't know their rights or may not be part of a union, they've got no say. They can't say no. Where some staff are paid £40 an hour to work with COVID-19 patients. But if they die in the process, no insurance or danger money is given to them or their families for having been put in harm's way, because others who know their rights have said that they're not putting their families at risk. So find someone else. Do those people still have a job? Yeah. Do their unions back them? Of course. Black people are being used to prop up COVID-19 figures, and I believe it's a hidden agenda. Fear is the key. And whilst they're blinding us with all this stuff, they're putting legislation and other things through that we're not able to see, that we're blinded by. You know what? I'm just going to stop there because I'm still in my feelings. So let's go to the next stage of grief. Depression. Just a deep, deep sadness that makes me just want to moan. There's a WhatsApp media file going around where people are singing, "We shall overcome, we shall overcome, we shall overcome someday. Oh, deep in my heart, I do believe we shall overcome someday." But when? And then the final stage of grief is acceptance. So they say. You just want answers. You want me to work with you, but part of me is broken and I want to get up and push through to find solutions, but that isn't going to work because it's been hundreds of years. And right now, Windrush is just the tip of the iceberg. A friend did send me the link of David Jones' media production titled "How Can We Win?", where an amazing young black woman in America called Kimberly Jones, who articulated or spoke just how I felt, and she did it so well. She referred to racism. She referred racism to a game of Monopoly, that we have been playing for 400 years. Where we haven't had the money, resources, or properties, but yet are still forced to play the game. Not only that, whatever money we might have earned, we have to give up because you hold all the property. When Black people finally created something out of nothing, like their own pieces, then they created their own resources, you burnt it down. And she refers to the Tulsa riots and massacre of 1921 and Rosewood, Florida, 1923. I think you should look those up. Because I'm not trying to use my platform for riling up hate. I'm trying to use my platform to have a voice from a particular perspective, to talk from a particular experience, and to uplift and try and help educate and move us forward. But she then goes on to say, you can't win. The game is fixed. And that's how many of us feel, and that's how I feel sometimes. No matter what I do, the goalposts change. But one thing she said, which really struck and stayed with me, she said, they're lucky. What people are looking for, what Black people are looking for, is equality and not revenge. I then saw a link from like Trevor Noah and his The Daily or something like that about social contract. He said that, you know, we have an understanding that, you know, there's a social contract which we all kind of abide by. But right now, it just seems that that's broken, and especially seems that way when you kill us in the street. When you use your white lens on your life of privilege to judge a Black person who hasn't had the same advantages. And even if we have had some advantages, you still don't see, you cannot see the world through my eyes, my lens. I mean, I'll put the links in wherever I put them, you know, you do the research. What my heart wants to do is to find a way to work side by side with everyone to build a different future. But I want you to respect the fact that I'm not going to rush up in front and try and lead anything. I'm just happy to use my experience to help my younger selves in their protesting and building the future that they want to see. How will things change? Where do I go to heal? Where do I go to get justice? Who or what do I believe in? The police shows us the value of our lives and represents how our government really sees us. And white people enjoying the privilege of their thinking, their lives, their living, their jobs. I'm just trying to work it out. I'm just thinking, how do I heal? How do I take care of me whilst continuing to work with those who are struggling in this COVID-19 lockdown? Because that's what I'm doing. I'm working with families who are invisible, who need help and support and to be empowered so they can take control of their lives and situations, and that they can have the same things that certain people in our community take for granted. I'm left thinking, what can I do moving forward to help those I currently work with And what can I do to encourage parents who are in general just trying to raise their children? And how can parent voices become more central in local and central government? As a parent, what example am I going to set for my children? What will be the legacy they can build upon? Boy, that feels heavy to me. So I owe it to myself to take some time and to try to do things through love and not anger. And not hurt. Well, no, I've got to acknowledge I feel hurt. And I say those words flippantly and just like they just cut and run off my tongue. But it's not easy. So anyway, I didn't really mean for this to be a depressing conversation. I just wanted some space to be able to speak about it the way I speak about stuff. In this week, I've come across some organizations that I want to tell you about. There's Black Minds Matters are providing Black people in the UK with free therapy with professional Black therapists. So if that's something you feel you want to explore, get in touch with them on www.blackmindsmatteruk, that's all one word, blackmindsmatteruk.com. I'll put a link, the information in my description. And even if you don't need their services, please consider donating. Another organization that I've been talking to this week has been blackthrive.org.uk. They can be found at www.blackthrive.org.uk. And they're also supporting local people in the local community. So look at the website and start your own healing. Or donate and support them too. And then the organization I work for is CHIPS, Christian International Peace Service. And they are at www.chipspeace.org. You know, donate to these organizations so that work in the local community can continue post COVID-19. Let's start to build a really connected community from a place of honesty. So I can't believe the cat hasn't interrupted us. So maybe she didn't need to this week. She's sleeping peacefully. So next episode, I don't know. You know, subscribe and you'll find out. Remember, we're all on a journey here. So like, share, follow. It's on Spotify, Google, iTunes. Thank you for listening. Wishing you and your loved ones daily blessings. Remain safe. Till next time, I'm out.